So I just had the good fortune to go to Abhayagiri for a week. And Abhayagiri Monastery, which is in California, it's a Theravada tradition. There's one of, I think I'm right, there's three male monasteries on the West Coast in Theravada tradition. There's Birkin in Canada, Abhayagiri, which is north of San Francisco, and then Metta Monastery with Ajahn Jeff down in the San Diego area. And I just want to share with you some of what I learned that, or kind of felt that I thought might be helpful. And I got four thoughts, just to make it simple. I'll kind of expand a little bit on each. And I want to tell you a little bit about the monastery. And part of why I'm convinced also these days that monasteries are important. I think monasteries here in 2022 are of both genders, male and female, are really, really, really important and help the Dharma move forward. And, you know, something that you might consider connecting with in different ways. And we did, by the way, because I might forget later, we did also visit Dhammadharini, which is a small nunnery, a female monastery, in out near Redwood City, basically, with, I think, four nuns. And that was lovely. And the two monks and the two nuns, three nuns, were just in a beautiful energy with each other, and it was really sweet. So I think here in 2022, some of those historic divisions are breaking down, especially in North America, about full ordination of nuns and about women being equal. Anyway, Abhayagiri is home to about 11 monks, and for Anagarikas, who are, in this case, men, who are in the process of becoming monks. So the monks are in full robes, Theravada-style full robes. The Anagarikas are wearing white. They're not robes, really. They're kind of just wearing pants and shirts or something. Anyway, white. And it's a beautiful place. It's 220 acres, so it's huge. Given by the land of 10,000 Buddhas. That's how the land happened down in L.A. They just gave them the site. And down on the, it's in a valley, so it goes all up one side of a valley. It's really steep. It's like crazy steep. and the buildings are all kind of tucked around just above this one little road that goes by. So being California on Saturday, it got a little loud with motorcycles, but most of the time it's really quiet. And there's sort of a cluster of buildings right around, up above the road, still quite a bit above where the main hall is. There's a secondary hall, there's a kitchen, and there's a library, some other stuff, and then there's a whole bunch of kudis scattered way up above, up, where there's people in retreat, which I didn't find out just sort of by accident later on. It's cool. Okay, so four things that struck me. One was this amazing harmony of the monks collaborating together. It was just this, I sort of just was like getting it over time, this sort of fluidity that just seemed so natural. And, you know, I mean, they're a little hard to tell apart. It took me a while because they've all got shaven heads and they're all basically thin because they eat one meal a day and they're all wearing exactly the same robes. And I'll get to the Vinaya towards the end, but there's certain restrictions on what they can do in a lot of different ways. So there's some similarity. But there was a sense that they were really paying attention and they really had goodwill and they really had a common purpose to support the Dharma. So things just kind of got passed off in different ways and it just sort of flowed. It was amazing. You know, there was no, and there wasn't much like figuring things out because they know what they're doing, but there's just this amazing not selfing happening, it seemed like, in a really striking way. And partly there was, you know, some of the, I mean, they have, as I'll touch on later, 227 rules of being a full monastic, but even there, there's doing eight precepts and you know, following the Four Noble Truths, so there was a lack of idle chatter. You know, people weren't particularly telling the stories of themselves. Sometimes there was some really authentic conversations between visitors and with monastics. It was open. It was really heartfelt. But there's a way in which when people get together, they all kind of tell the stories of themselves to each other to kind of position themselves with each other, like at parties and stuff. That wasn't happening. It was real interesting. There was a real sort of quiet that permeated things and a lot of talk about outer phenomena, you know, like the news or that kind of stuff just didn't happen. Plus, we're unplugged. I mean, they weren't so much because it's a very dialed in place, digitally speaking. But we guests were asked to, you know, keep our phones off, don't bring computers, all that kind of stuff. So I had no idea what was going on for a week. I did text my wife, however. But aside from that, didn't. So there was a real sense of a kind of a connection of energy. And I think because it's, you know, it's different from a retreat, everyone goes and they're all in silence in a certain way and there's a teacher and everyone's kind of not really relating. This was a community. This was very much a community in a real warm way. And there was this real warmth. You know, it was interesting that there's a way in which this is a wisdom tradition. So, you know, we're seeing not self, we're seeing the impermanence of things, and there's the wisdom aspect, but it was really striking how there's a warmth that came out also, even though some of these guys were pretty sparse, I gotta say, but there was an underlying warmth. It was real interesting to see how they fit together, and particularly Ajahn Pasano, who was a senior disciple of Ajahn Chah, and I'm humbly, I got a chance to meet him 34 years ago in Thailand, when he was abbot of Wat Phanan Chah, which is the western branch monastery of the main monastery where Ajahn Chah was. And this is in Ubin Ratchathani out on the eastern edge of Thailand, right near the Cambodian border. So it was just kind of, he's just so great. And I've always really had him in my, I just loved him then. I was just there for a few days, but he really got to me then. So that's where he lives. He's not abbot anymore too. He's backed out of being abbot. So he's kind of, you know, sort of retired, but that just means he kind of glows most of the time. He's just this incredibly kind person. And he has this warmth and this kind of like sense of humor, and this amazing presence. And people really venerate him. I mean, he's done so many. There's sort of a hierarchy of monks, which is how many vasas. A vasa is a rain retreat. So how many vasas you've done is sort of like people reference each other a little bit. I don't know how many he's done, but it's like 35 or something. So he's really senior. And you sort of watch. I was really fascinated watching him. And he just had this kind of just this permeating goodwill. And you started to kind of tune in. There just wasn't any self-interest there. It was just, what would he want? You know, it was this great heartfelt sort of expansiveness with no particular agenda. And when I talked to him, you know, a few times, and he talked to people, and he just really, it's kind of like Dalai Lama, he just landed, you know, when someone was speaking, he just landed with him. It was pretty cool. I did have this. One of the things that really struck me from Wat Phanan Chah years and years and years ago was that in the front of the hall, there was a skeleton hanging, you know, human skeleton hanging there. And there was also, this doesn't sound weird, there was a baby in a bottle. I think a fetus, you know, preserved in a bottle, which was pretty striking, you know, end of life, beginning of life. And it really struck me and it stuck with me ever since. And I asked him, are they still there? And he said, well, skeleton's still there. He said the baby in the bottle started getting weird and it was like getting discolored and they finally buried it or whatever they did. So, it was funny. So I worked in the kitchen, which is kind of where if you ever visit, and I'll tell you about the schedule later, but most people end up clocking a lot of time in the kitchen. And it's just the darndest thing. We were feeding about 30 people between the monastics and guests and had this, and then as one of the anagarikas was sort of head in this sort of vaguely unstructured way, and he'd sort of say, you know, if someone was volunteering who had some cooking experience, who's kind of checking, and he'd say, well, here's a bunch of eggs. Is anything you want to make? And they say, well, yeah, I'll do this thing. Okay, go for it. And it's just sort of, let's have a protein. And there was a little sense of what was in the, what had been donated and what was available. And people sort of were flowing around and kind of watching the clock, because at 11, the bell rings. And so I did that a bunch of times. Because I can't, I got this heart problem, so carrying large things up really steep hills isn't exactly what I do anymore. And it was just the most, I got to say, it was an incredibly mellow thing, considering it was intense. They call that the pressure cooker of the monastery, because you got to hit it. It's got to be done by 11. And it's amazing how much food there is. And then what's really funny is that sometimes there's something on those little whiteboard, and sometimes you know, oh, some Thai people are bringing some food, so cool, kind of provide for that, some food's coming. But other times we were like, you know, an hour and a half, just full hour rolling with all this stuff, and all of a sudden these cars pull up and Thai people are bringing food. It's like, oh, okay, so let's stop that, put it in the freezer, put it in the refrigerator, bring out this Thai food, and just flowing with it. And because me, my organizing self is like, you should tell us next time we're going to bring food. You know, I had this little thing in my mind. It was like, no, that wasn't how it was working. It was just flowing. So it was cool. No one got grumpy about these sudden appearances. And it was really lovingly received. And it all worked every single time. It just, right at 11, it worked, rang the bell. People got fed. The second thing that really struck me.
Who rang the bell?
Different people volunteered. They said yeah. And by the way, the bell is this big gong in the middle, and it's made from the tip of a bomb from Laos. And it sounds really good, but it's the tip of a bomb that didn't blow up, I guess, but nonetheless, probably from a B-52 or something, I don't know, or Cambodia. So the second thing that really struck me was just during the practice, it was deep. It's hard to describe what it was, and I'll just, the circumstance is that every morning at 5 a.m. and in the evening at 7 p.m., all the monastics and visitors gather together. And first there's a chanting session and then meditation. It's about an hour and a half in the evening and an hour in the morning. So you got to get up at 4:30 to be in the hall at 5, or whatever you got to get up to be in the hall at 5. And so the monks are in their robes, or kind of along the side wall of the quite long, beautiful, incredibly beautiful hall with a great big Buddha in the center. And there's two rows of them, and the Anagarikas are there too, and the older people are across. And during the chanting, which a lot of the monks just do from memory, there's a whole book, but a lot of them are just doing it, there's a real sense of just how special this moment was. It didn't feel like, oh, I've done this 45 times, and they do different chants anyway, but there was a real sense of presence. I watched Ajahn Pasano a couple of times also. When he's bowing, he just bows to the Buddha. It's amazing. He's been doing it, you know, 40 whatever years, and he just bows to the Buddha. But then after the chanting's over, about 3 times, and then they sit in meditation, and this stillness will whoosh over the room. And it's hard to describe, but, you know, I'm sort of, what do I say? I'm learning, and we're all learning, and you can kind of feel this like clutter in the energy sometimes. And a lot of people are practicing, and their kind of stuff is churning around. You can kind of feel it a little bit out there. This was like amazing. It was just this with like, it was so dense or clean or pure or something. It's almost like you cut it with a knife, just this sense of this continuity of awareness just happening. It was just amazing. And it was really, I mean, it really helped. But you could really feel the monastics, they just settled in, and most of them just didn't move. And they just settled in. I remember when I was at Wat Pa Nan Cha, they do a all night. In Thailand, it was a little more rigorous. It was all night on the full moon and the half moon. I think four times a month, full moon, half moon. And I tried, you know, way back when. But I remember when I finally gave up around 1:30 in the morning or something, I was watching Ajahn Pasano back then, 32, and he hadn't moved one bit the entire time. It's like, oh my God, how do you do that? You know, hours and hours and hours, just not even moving. So I guess it was just a reminder, an uplifting about what we're capable of, because these are just regular guys, you know, just regular guys who had other things they were doing before they became monastics. And I just really took it in as helping me see what's possible for all of us. It was really inspiring. And so how does this happen? You know, how can people reach such depths? And I was really, in the context, some things kind of popped out in the context of the monastery. And one was right effort. You know, and in the Eightfold Path, it's number 6. You don't talk about right effort so much as mindfulness or ethics or, but right effort, when you're in a monastery, it kind of jumps out at you more because there's a lot of right effort going on. It's not easy being a monastic. And the whole thing takes a lot of intention and work to pull off, to make the monastery run, to do the practice. And so I want to talk about that, about there's a third thing, just determination, right effort. It's worth thinking about what it takes to be a monastic in a monastery, and then kind of roll that back to ourselves in terms of our own practice, and how could that inspire us? Or how could that be a context that we could use to think about the way we approach practice? Because that's part of why they're doing it, is to help the rest of the world. The schedule, I'll tell you about the schedule because it relates to this. It's simple, but it's intense, and it's kind of relentless because it goes on day after day after day after day. There's no like formal. We did have a day off, but it was kind of like a random day off. Can't remember why. But everyone gets up at 4:30 for this chanting and meditation, so get in the hall at 5, ends at 6:30. And then there's this quick 30 minutes of cleanup chores. It's kind of interesting. There'll be a monk and he says, well, you do this, you do that, you know, you go clean the windows downstairs and you go sweep over here. And so everyone kind of does stuff for 30 minutes. And then breakfast is at 7. So it's no like kind of hanging around. It's like you're instantly on after sitting. Breakfast is at 7, and then at 7:30, so you got to be finished by 7:30. There's no hanging around. There's a community meeting where one of the monks gives kind of an update. Everyone sits. It's a small Dhamma hall. And everyone sits around a perimeter. You can bring your tea in because there is tea. And there's an update about what's happening and if someone's going somewhere or just a little bit of community. The community is kind of communicating with itself, and we visitors were kind of hangers-on. But then there's also like basically assignments, like you're going to do this and you're going to do that. And they told you when you agreed to go, just, you know, just accept whatever comes up. Don't try to bargain for, you know, unless you got a medical condition or something. But so boom, 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 you people are going to go this and this. And it's just this real quick lineup of who's doing what. And then everyone piles back into the kitchen to clean up. And then there's the work period. The work period is the morning. So the whole work period is from then till just before 11. And if they say, if you get back like 5 or 10:45 or something, go into the kitchen. Because a lot of times there's last minute stuff and a few people would suddenly arrive and save the day just to hit that deadline. And then the afternoon is wide open for practice and study and anything you need. After everyone piles back in after lunch and cleans up the kitchen, which is an enormous task, but with about 30 people or 20 people doing it, it goes pretty fast. And then the afternoon's open. And, you know, it's basically, I just treated it like a retreat. You know, some little bit of study, walking and sitting, and a lot of monastics, that's what they're doing. Some of them may have other stuff, but the whole place just went quiet. And people were on their own practicing, but there wasn't any work. It was really nice. It was a very clean demarcation. Work in the morning, not work in the afternoon. So it was really rich. And then at 5:30, there's tea. And that includes a gathering with a senior monk in a small place for kind of a conversation, which is really fun. And just sort of questions or discussion or... And they're usually pretty funny, actually. And then right after that is the evening practice at 7 for 90 minutes and then finishes about 8:30 and you can practice a little longer and go to sleep and get up at 4:30 in the morning. So that's just like day after day after day. So there's a lot of, you know, determination and right effort and focus. I mean, there wasn't a lot of dilly-dallying or shilly-shallying or entertainment. Well, there wasn't any entertainment. They don't do entertainment. You know, it's part of the Vinaya. No music, no random entertainments, no dancing, celebration, a whole bunch of stuff that monks can't do or participate in. And so you can see that this determination to practice and this sense of stirring energy makes the monastery run really smoothly. And this also has to do with their practice. You know, they're really there to work toward nibbana. I mean, is that they came up here and there. It's like they're doing it. And so it was impressive. And by the way, some of the monastery has one of the best equipped wood shops I've ever seen. And they're now milling wood from their own trees to make lumber to build kutis. So they actually do during the work period some pretty heavy stuff. There's things you can't do. You can't dig in the earth. Monks can't. So they can't grow things because of the Vinaya rules. But they do amazing stuff. And then went back, way back up into this trails, go back up and up. It's all very steep. But there was kutis way back there, and there were some monks doing the extended retreat. They sort of took a break from this, and they were doing retreats. So in the middle of all this, there were monks on individual retreat, which was really interesting. And one of them was, I talked to one of them, he was on a fasting retreat. I didn't ask him how long since he'd eaten, but it wasn't, I don't know. I don't know how he was doing it. And then another one was preparing to go on what's called Tudong, which I do in Thailand, but it's basically a monk just wanders off with a begging bowl and his requisites. So, you know, inner robe, outer robe, begging bowl, umbrella, needle, water filter, a sitting cloth, and that's it. And just goes wandering off through California for a few hundred miles. And they do that pretty often, which is just kind of blows my mind. But it works. People sort of get it enough that they end up not starving, and it's a complete interdependence with people, and really using that as a time of practice. So it was another kind of effort. And there was just that sense of cultivating mindfulness, you know? That's what they talked about. It came up here and there. It's like, yeah, that's what we're doing. We're being aware moment by moment. That's what we're cultivating moment by moment in the middle of all this stuff. And you could really see how it's just woven through. So, you know, it just made me think, take a look at how much Dharma effort I actually put in during the course of a day, you know? I mean, from their point of view, it's 24/7. And, you know, that's an aspiration, but this kind of like raised the bar. I got to say, it raised the bar. And, you know, insofar as we get, like you were talking about the, you know, the Christmas dance or whatever dances are in our life, or, you know, the whole giant sort of industrial entertainment machine out there, all that stuff that attracts our attention to whatever degree we can not be wrapped up in that and just really cultivate awareness moment by moment, you know, we're coming closer to the kind of power that the monastics hold, which is wonderful that it's still happening here in 2022. And then the last thing I wanted to talk about a little bit that struck me, these are all just things that kind of struck me, I guess, was the underlying significance of ethics, and in their case, the Vinaya, which as some of you may know is the 227 rules for monks. And here's the book. Where am I? Oh, I can't even tell what camera. Can you see the book? Are you nodding? Anybody nodding? Can't see it. How would I do it? I'm confused. Oh, I guess I'll pull it up later. You can see me, right? Can you see me? You can't see me. Is that right?
Only from behind.
Oh, my bad. Someone should have told me. I'm sorry.
Boink. We can see you.
Yeah. I apologize. I could have fixed that. It's hard to, okay, there's me, but it didn't matter. Who needs to see me? But anyway, here's the book. This is a Vinaya code. Pretty amazing. So it's just a big part. I apologize. There's a lot of things to control here, and it's hard to keep track. They meet like every week to have a meeting about refresh on the Vinaya, because there's rules and sub-rules and sub-sub-rules, and there's all kinds of aspects and subtleties. And then they also, there's a tremendous openness, and it's all kinds of, and I don't pretend to be any expert, but there's some things that if you break the rule, you're no longer a monk, you're out. There's names for these things, and there's some other things, if you break a rule, then you can apologize and kind of do amends and you're not out, but don't do it again. And there's other things that are subtler, and you just say, oh, I did this thing, and it's like, okay, could you confess, don't do it again. So there's many levels. You know, if you kill someone, you're out. But you could, it permeates. There's a lot of discussion about the Vinaya, a lot of discussion about ethics. It just permeates what goes on there. And I could see in a way I hadn't seen before, it feels like it almost made the importance of ethical behavior jump out more than is so, maybe not so obvious in other places, because it was a huge area of interest. And, you know, and it's hard to be a monk because there's a whole bunch of parameters you're working within that might not occur to us because we don't know. And so they really got to pay attention. But that act of really paying attention, you could see how it really, it was important. It was a huge part of what drove the practice and made it all work. And so it made me really sort of think more deeply about, you know, that aspect of my life and just how to keep working that, how absolutely fundamental it is. I mean, basically you can't advance on the spiritual path if your sila's messed up. You may look like you're advancing, but you're not. You know, there's been some teachers who, they have some charisma, they have some insight, but they're not actually advancing on the spiritual path if they're, you know, breaking sila, if they're abusing their power in some way or something like that. And also there was one Anagarika, and I, you know, under the heading of confidentiality, but who was struggling with an area, and he made a fairly significant mistake a number of times, but there was a real place to talk about it. You know, it was complete honesty. He could just talk about it in these gatherings, and they were trying to help him work around that. So it was very, he said, it's totally open. It's not loaded. It's just, this is what, this is how it's got to be. But it wasn't loaded or emotional or guilty or anything. It was just very sort of, what's going to help on the path? What's going to help the community? And it's interesting being there because, you know, it's 8 precepts. I mean, you commit yourself to 8 precepts. So it's, you know, clarifying, no eating after noon. You know, if you're no sort of suggestiveness of sexuality, not to mention no sexuality. And so it's kind of purifying in a way to be there. And it just shows you how much this, the core activity of just how, I think how we conduct ourselves in body, speech, and mind is so important. And then the intention behind how we conduct ourselves, and these things all kind of got popped out more because it was a community. It wasn't just a retreat where you're sort of in this more rigid space. It was a community where you're interacting with people, and it really brought it out more. So I think that's pretty much what I have to say, but just, it was just so amazing to see the harmony and kind of the kindness and selflessness that was there. Okay, let me just sit for a moment.